This is The Reason Podcast, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. As part of Reason's ongoing 50th anniversary celebration, the magazine was founded in 1968, 50 years ago, half a century. I'm talking with all of the former editors who are still alive of Reason Magazine. We've talked so far to Robert W. Poole, as well as Virginia Postrel. Today, it's my intense pleasure to speak with Matt Welch, who is also not just a colleague of mine, but also a co-author. Back in 2011 and 2012, we published the Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. We're going to talk about Matt's tenure as editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, which lasted from 2008 until the spring of 2016. He, of course, is still an editor-at-large at Reason. And we're going to talk about the high points of his editorship of the magazine, as well as some of the lowlights, and get his take on what was happening during that eight-year period that he was calling all the shots for the print magazine. Matt, thank you so much for talking.
Thank you very much. And I'm just a reminder that I saw Elliot Abrams, the former Bush administration and Iran Contra criminal, I believe. I saw him give a talk earlier this week, and I asked him about you know, what mistakes, name any mistakes that the Bush administration made during its 8 years. And he looked at me very square in the eye, and he said, "We made no mistakes. Everything that we did was perfect."
Wow.
And I think that's my new answer for my eight-year tenure. Everything we did, Nick, was perfect.
It's been good talking to you. You know, so that pretty much settles it. Yeah. You know, when Bush administration flunkies are saying that there were no mistakes made, you know, boy, we got you know, suddenly Donald Trump doesn't seem to be that big a threat to what's wrong with America. So, well, let's get down to brass tacks. You know, and the major kind of seismic event that was happening while you were editor of the magazine really was the financial crisis. Although then you also have the Barack Obama presidency. Other things. How do you kind of think about the period when you were editor of the magazine?
So I came in a, you know, a friendly baton handoff from you to an institution and a magazine that, you know, had attracted me. I just liked it. So it was a different kind of case than, hey, you know, come here and turn this thing around type of business. And so my heading into it, I was going to take as given the gains that were made first under really Virginia Postrel by, you know, the way that she kind of professionalized this libertarian publication and helped bring in this great generation, the greatest generation of Jacob Sullum and you and
Ron Bailey, Jesse Walker, Brian Doherty.
I know Brian Doherty is maybe more directly under you. But so take those gains, take the Nick Gillespie gains of the sort of, you know, getting in touch with the 90s kind of alternative technology roots, Louis Rossetto, this type of suckification. Take both of those as given and now what and going forward. And so this is prior to the financial crisis, but this kind of to get into my my approach toward it. I felt like, okay, so let's do a couple of things. One, I felt like we, having had the good fortune of working on the 35th anniversary issue under your guidance. I think I was filling in for, you know, someone was on book sabbatical, but I went back and read every last issue, which is just a wonderful, marvelous privilege to be able to do that, and thought, hey, you know what? Kind of back when we were still fighting the Cold War, back when Milton Friedman was right there in the trenches, there was a lot of kind of basic argumentation about capitalism, about free market economics, and things like that. That was taking up less and less space, maybe in the magazine. So I felt like, hey, let's try to find ways to boost that. And then the other part was I felt like, especially as sort of a latecomer to the term libertarian, and, you know, at any given point, the biggest squish in the room, or like the least qualified philosophical libertarian in the room, or at least so I thought, going in. That gave me paradoxically a confidence in the sense of the libertarian identity that maybe old timer libertarians don't have, because they're afraid that the word is weird and people confuse it with librarian. I mean, for me, libertarianism is this really kind of broad, interesting, vibrant thing that's with us forever. It's not a fragile flower that's going to die if, you know, it's associated with this person and that person flames out or anything like that. So a more kind of self-conscious and self-confident coverage both of libertarianism and just kind of a demonstration of the libertarian identity. And so obviously what happens is, I think within the first week of me being the editor-in-chief of the magazine, it comes the re-exhumation of the Ron Paul newsletter controversy.
Right.
So it's a really good way to...
Yeah, Cap, summarize that for people who may have forgotten or, you know, let their subscription to the Ron Paul Survival Report lapse.
So... A hostile reporter, Jamie Kirchick, I think it was in the New Republic, rediscovered some newsletters from the late 90s or the late 80s and early 90s that were done under Ron Paul's name in the Ron Paul Survivor Report and other places in his lucrative newsletters franchise that contained just awful stuff. It's sort of objectively racist material. He went back and found a treasure trove of these things in a library somewhere.
And this was, these were mentions of Martin Luther King as like a child rapist and things like that, right? And
I mean, it was,
and
yeah,
the criminality of blacks. I mean, it was, there was nothing there, you know, there was nothing kind of questionable at this. This was really awful kind of trolling of the worst impulses of Americans.
And this is in 2008, and then there the Ron Paul kind of revolution was in full swing. It was really attracting new people into libertarianism. It was a huge hit on college campuses. Thousands of people on college campuses were coming out and chanting "End the Fed" and talking about ending our wars and things like that. So it was a real kind of a kick in the nuts to all this. And so we had a lot of requests from readers like, "Hey, what happened? Can you investigate this?" And so we did, and we commented on it. And you know, that was a moment that a lot of people were mad at us and thought that we were, that's a stab in the back theory for Ron Paul. But for me, it was also like, "Hey, look, we cover stuff on our beat. This is what we do."
Yeah. The main story was about who actually wrote the Ron Paul newsletters, right? Because there was. Ron Paul said, and many people believed him, and I guess to some degree I do, that he had no idea who wrote them and that he didn't read them. They just went out under his name, which even to say that out loud is too,
yeah, it's kind of,
you know,
hard.
Come on.
But from what we know of the man, and I certainly know him a lot more now than I did back then, but it kind of squares with it. That's not him. That's not his personality. Is not one of intolerance. It's kind of the opposite. He speaks pretty movingly about, you know, Muhammad Ali refusing to go to Vietnam and some of the lessons he learns from Martin Luther King and these types of things. So people around him, but he's also one of his tendencies is that his close intimates he will never throw under the bus, no matter what kind of weird things that he said. So this all kind of combined, and that was fun, actually. I mean, it's always a interesting to go through, but the whole experience for me was bracing. You know, we cover stuff on our beat, and that's one of the ways that you get credibility with your own audience first, and then with outsiders secondly. So this was the kind of through line going in. The 40th anniversary issue, which happened in that fall, was the final issue right before the financial crisis hit. And again, it was like, hey, let's celebrate this crazy, weird history of reason and be confident with it. I commissioned a really long oral history from Brian Doherty that was really fun about reason. And then, boom, financial crisis hits. And that really dominated coverage of all of that. And I remember probably a couple of things from that stand out. One is the sense, and I think the first column that the editor's note that I had at the time had a headline like "Back to the Barricades." Like, okay, we know we have to remake these arguments that we thought we didn't have to argue anymore. And the moment that really hit me was the George W. Bush speech to the nation on September 24th of 2000. and 8, where he's like, normally I'm a big believer in free market capitalism, but.
you got a bigger butt than Sir Mix-a-Lot sang about, right? Coming whenever anybody is, normally I'm this, but.
Now that I remember that, I was watching that from the green room of that really terrible MSNBC location in the middle of Washington, D.C., not even the 400 North Cap. I was going to go on Rachel Maddow for my only time I've ever been on that program to this day to talk about my John McCain book, which is also another interesting thing to have in the middle of a presidential season in my first year as editor. But you could tell that, all right, so everyone is freaking out. And our instinct, you know, I think editorially, if I can speak for the we, that includes you, was that, hey, everyone's freaking out about this in ways that is not very specific. Whole lot of people saying, you know, like Michael Bloomberg saying, it doesn't matter what we do, we just need to do something. David Brooks was inveighing against the nihilists out there, the do-nothing nihilists in the House Republican caucus. And we started asking the questions, what is the thing that you want to do precisely, and how does this play into the kind of moral hazard that we see out there? I think her instinct was rightfully in that moment, and very lonely in that moment. It was, hey, let's step back and don't presume that we have to have a massive fiduciary and regulatory response to this thing. Around that time, David Knott, president of the Reason Foundation, and I went to New York for a week, or almost a week, to kind of gut check that, because we all sort of had that response. So we wanted to talk to people in our universe who worked directly in Wall Street, sometimes for the big investment banks themselves, sometimes for funds that were making money off of this because they've been predicting a buildup of consumer debt and other things. And it was fascinating, and it really is. It's colored my vision ever since then. The closer that these people, and these are like longtime libertarians in good standing, the closer that these people were to the fiery molten lava center of the whole thing. If they're at the Bear Stearns or a Lehman, and we talked to at least one person from one of those banks, the closer they were, the less specific they were about what went wrong and what needs to be done, and the more likely they were to be like, oh, you know, we just got to do something because, you know, we broke the buck.
Yeah.
And that's all over. We have to
We need to water the animal spirits of the market, right? Just to show that somebody's paying attention, somebody's kind of in charge or something.
It really, really was that. And I mean, it's the great unfalsifiable theorem, right? Of saying, who knows? Maybe we would all be eating out of tin cups if they hadn't passed the series of bailouts and then the stimulus afterwards. Let's admit that we don't know how to prove that. At the same time, if you go back and look at the speech, and I don't know if it was the same speech, I think it was from George W. Bush, talking about what would happen if we don't pass this bailout package, because remember it failed in the House first, and then people came around after they were all scared properly by the political class. He described a world in which unemployment might go, you know, north of 10%, where there'd be widespread failure of banks, where this would happen. And this, everything that he predicted, literally everything that he predicted as a bad consequence if we don't pass this, happened after we passed it. And yet he didn't, the people who supported that didn't blink twice. So this, the first year, 2 years after that, the bulk of cover stories were all about that, and we were just like grappling with economic policy, stimulus, Obamacare came prominence around then as well.
Can I ask what, you know, how would you summarize? So, you know, what was the reason take or you know, in the magazine under your guidance, what was the basic explanation for why the financial crisis happened? And then what was wrong about the bailouts of banks and then auto companies and pension funds? And then eventually, you know, as we get into the Obama years, because Bush also had, he passed the stimulus in the form of, I guess, tax rebates in the beginning of 2008. It was kind of a premonition, that something was kind of squirrely with the economy. But, you know, what was the basic rationale for why the financial crisis happened, and then what was wrong with the actual response that both Republicans and Democrats put forward. And I can remember thinking, because you had written McCain, Myth of a Maverick, you know, it came out, McCain was the nominee. He suspended his campaign in order to go back and vote for the Senate bailout bill. And then, of course, Obama took, you know, a later plane and did the same thing. And it was this weird moment where you realized, okay, you know, the, you know, what Gore Vidal or other people say, that, you know, there aren't two parties in America. There's a right wing and a left wing of, you know, of the same party. It seemed to be very much the case.
And interestingly, the political science on the McCain-Obama matchup comes to pretty much one main conclusion. What was like an issue or a point that proved to be decisive? And what it was is that after the financial crisis, a very clear spread of Americans believed in or trusted Obama's economic policies in response to it over McCain's. Mm. And that to me is a great failure on McCain's part. Yes, he did showily suspend his campaign. Then he came to Washington and like was a dead rug in a meeting in the White House. Didn't really add anything to anything. He at some point he said, "Oh, let's just nationalize mortgages." Like, okay,
right.
There wasn't really a clear free market alternative coming out of, and that's the. I mean, he has admitted in other times that that's really not his strong suit, anyways. And so that's another sign that the kind of traditional, you know, kind of Goldwaterite, Reaganite sense of free market economics had just really become unmoored in the Republican Party and wasn't being defended with any sense of vigor or insight. So what I did is immediately sort of sent people out. Let's take what everyone is saying about this and investigate whether it's true. Was George W. Bush a particularly big deregulator? Did deregulation caused this thing? Well, you can measure a lot of regulatory activity, including in the financial markets. And as Veronique DeRougie and Catherine Mangu Ward and other people found, he was a much bigger regulator than Bill Clinton had been, especially in financial markets. If you recall the and I'm blanking on the name of it, but his post-Enron series of reforms.
Yeah, Sarbanes-Oxley.
Sarbanes-Oxley.
Yeah.
You know, he said there will be no more Enrons. This is the greatest bit of financial regulation since the Great Depression, and it'll help prevent future ones. Okay, that was like 2003, 2004. And so, all right, let's drill down in the very specific one. Is it the repeal of Glass-Steagall and the division between, you know, the sort of wall in between investment banks and other types of things? And unclear at the end whether how much of a role that played. There's an argument that created some kind of sense of gambling that didn't exist before, but there's also an argument that the most healthy financial institutions afterwards were precisely those who had taken advantage of the reduction in those roles. So we tried to steel man all of these arguments, to use a bad phrase, and look at it. So it was more that, hey, there was a huge, huge moral hazard created by the federal government doing two things, which is reducing interest rates to nothing, and also to say, and you know, goose as much as possible home ownership rules everywhere. And then, so like when you know that you're going to, at the end of the rainbow, that there's a government a backstop, just to mix all the metaphors, then you can start creating all kinds of really wonderful speculative instruments that are around that, because you know, no matter what, you're going to get this backstop. So
it's basically, I mean, it's the idea that the government, through a wide variety of policies that, you know, corporate America and Wall Street certainly wanted at the time, including, you know, low inflation rates, so people are going to buy stocks and bonds or whatever, you know, guaranteed loans for mortgages, you know, where anybody could get a mortgage, you know, without even having, in many cases, without even having to show any kind of validation or verification of income or anything like that. Or that the bank had checked out a property. And they knew, you know, they were inflating a bubble, and everybody kind of figured either openly or on the sly that if something went south, they would be bailed out.
Yeah, the bailout of the long-term financial corporation forget exactly when that happened. I think I want to say 1999, but maybe I'm screwing that up. But that also that kind of created the template. And so when we allowed, and I'm again the screwing up the precise order of events, mm-hmm. I'm sure, but Lehman is the one that went under, or Bear Stearns went under. One of those two.
Yeah. They eventually
was allowed
did,
to go under.
Yes.
It was treated as the panic around that wasn't necessarily a panic about the whole system's going to collapse. It was an expression of surprise that the expected federal backstop wasn't there. So it's unfalsifiable, but this was our hunch, and that hunch now taking over to the stimulus. Was that the stimulus was again sold as this thing that's going to lead to, if you don't pass it, we're going to have this levels of unemployment. Well, we did get all of that. But our basic argument against the stimulus was that you're going to throw so much debt on this pile here, you're not going to withdraw it. It's not going to be a true Keynesian stimulus, mm-hmm. Which is to say, that the theory behind it is let's inject a whole bunch of money because otherwise there won't be any money sloshing around, but then withdraw it after it's done, after we don't need to do it anymore. So let's increase government spending, let's say by $800 billion dollars. I always get those wrong. But then within a year or two, let's reduce it by that much. Well, no, of course, government spending almost never works like that. It's just a ratchet. And so we said what's going to happen is that you're going to get a lower growth when we come out of this for a protracted period of time, and we are more likely to, as one of our my most racist covers pointed out, we're going to turn Japanese. It's going to be more of a long, slow slide. We're going to have inadequate kind of impotent growth here. And I think our predictions about what would happen both with the stimulus and with the bailouts proved way more accurate than the predictions of the other people. Again, it's unfalsifiable, but that was our theory of the case. And it was really a lonely theory at the beginning.
Yeah, I can remember that, where it's, because even people on the free market, or especially people in the free market community, obviously people who are of a more interventionist bent were like, yeah, this all proves that we need to spend even more money. But if I'm remembering correctly, the Wall Street Journal editorialized in favor of the big bailout, the Bush bailout at the end of 2008. There weren't a lot of people who were willing to say, let it burn.
Yeah. I mean, the feeling, sense I've gotten from traveling up here in New York, with David Knott is that, there people had just been protected, and built in to their models, a sense of protection from the kind of cleansing destruction of bankruptcy. And then they were able to leverage that idea, and we saw this with the auto bailouts as well. How can we scare people about bankruptcy? Well, let's pretend it's liquidation. And this was true with the auto bailout. Like, if we don't bail them out, then all of these factories will disappear, and no one will ever build cars again. That's not mm-hmm. how any of that worked. But those were the arguments that we were up against. So this was this sense of. And The Economist magazine, Paul Ryan was in favor of all this kind of stuff. Yeah. Sort of alleged free market hero that my liberal friends try to say, oh, you love your Paul Ryan. It's like, what are you even talking about? We were covering all of this in real time and finding that that there weren't a lot of people. However, right around there is the beginnings of the rise of the Tea Party movement, mm-hmm. where you did see a lot of, at least initially, analysis like this. And there's kind of a reinvigoration of certain types of politicians who came in after that, the Rand Paul, Mike Lee generation.
You got to admit Ted Cruz is also in there, and Marco Rubio. So rose has its thorn, right?
Absolutely. And I think as we talk in 2018, the notion of the Tea Party is kind of self-evidently ridiculous. I don't think it exists.
At least we're talking about it, right? Because the only thing less talked about is Occupy, right? Which also grew out of the financial crisis. And, Occupy seems to have completely disappeared without a trace, or has it? Maybe I'm being too glib about that, because the Tea Party change. I mean, there was an election in 2010 and then again in 2012 in many ways where, you know, a lot of the people that we certainly like, you know, the Mike Lees, the Rand Pauls of the world were elected, the Justin Amashes and Thomas Massies were elected. But, you know, is the, talk a little bit about the appeal of the Tea Party versus Occupy. And then, you know, which side, if either, which movement, which were both kind of grassroots movements, which one has had the longer shelf life?
I don't know if we know the answer to that final question, really, because you sort of alluded to it. Part of the set of ideas, economic ideas, and the passion behind Occupy are becoming more and more mainstreamed within the Democratic Party. I mean, they find their expression in the insurgent candidacy of Bernie Sanders and in other people. And in the economic policies in cities like Seattle, like it's much more like the center of gravity in the Democratic Party has moved way to the left. And the thing that's really making people passionate is the economic policy part of it, much more sadly than necessarily the civil libertarian part of it that was at various points kind of bubbling up on under the late stages of the Bush administration, the kind of anti-war, the pro pot legalization. That's still there, but whatever. It's not really the most highly motivated thing. But yes, a lot of that energy transferred itself into the party. Tea Party energy, some of it definitely transferred itself in the party. At the 2012 Republican convention, for example, I mean, all of the juice, of all of the electricity coming from the stage was from Tea Party people, all of them. And that includes your Ted Cruz's, but definitely Rand Paul and all that. It was very interesting because behind the scenes, the Romney campaign was absolutely crushing on every level any outbursts of like Tea Party grassroots organization or any organization associated with Rand Paul, who was still, you know, he'd won five states and and they're busy just like giving those people the boot. It was really an interesting kind of dynamic, and it made we spent a lot of time covering like, you know, who's going to win this battle for the soul of the party. And I think if anything, we've covered those dynamics and we continue to. But the people who were hardcore true believers on actually cutting the size of government, actually challenging you know, executive authority, regardless of who wields it, all of that, that's really, you can put those numbers of people on the political representatives on one hand. It's a shrinking number of people, and quite a lot of people who came to office claiming those things, talking about those things. And I'm looking at a lot of people at the Freedom Caucus right now, Mark Meadows in particular, who's the chair. They turned out to be all wet when it comes to all of these things, or most of these things, let's say.
Well, you know, one of the problems with the Tea Party, too, and I can remember you and I covering the, you know, the marches in D.C., which were, you know, pretty stunning, both in terms of the size, but also the kind of authenticity of the people there early on who were really, you know, overwhelmingly seemed to be kind of like Ron Paul people, in that it was, for many of them, it was the first time they had done anything political, much less public. And they were just pissed off that, you know, under Bush and then, you know, kind of hyper tracked under Obama, at least in the first year of the Obama budgets or spending in 2009, there was just so much spending with no thought of how to pay for it or where it went. But I can remember you, Matt, I think, really hammering this home, that you, the point that the Tea Party, when it started to stray from that essential message that the government was spending too much, that it was going to lose, you know, kind of lose focus and lose energy and lose influence. And one of the things as the Tea Party kind of grew, it became weirdly both pro-military or at least defense spending, but then even worse, it became anti-immigrant. And that was, you know, immigration policy took up a lot of time and ink and pages, I think rightly under your editorship. How did that play out with regards to the Tea Party as well as the kind of broader Republican Party, do you think?
Yeah, it's an interesting bleed over because at first, a lot of the kind of anti-immigration sentiment within the Republican Party was not in the Tea Party. It was actually more in the establishment. Mitt Romney is the pre-Donald Trump when it comes to all that. Joe Arpaio worked for Mitt Romney. Yeah. The guy who headed up Mitt Romney's immigration policy was Chris Kobach. He's the clown who's the Secretary of State in Kansas, who's like the biggest conspiracy theorist about the millions of illegal immigrant voters allegedly out there. He's a Romney guy. Romney beat up all of his competitors in 2008 and 2012 on immigration. They're all
His policy was that Mexicans should self-deport, and he attacked Governor Rick Perry of Texas saying that immigration was an act of love, which I even thinking about it, it kind of brings tears to my eyes because I think it's correct.
Yeah, I mean, he really did that. And so it was there. It was also like Tom Tancredo and Duncan Hunter types. But there was a big kind of mainstream element of that. And it wasn't in those early Tea Party protests. I went to those protests very, very skeptical. Not expecting to find, I mean, I don't ever expect to find people at a political protest who I'm going to agree with very much after long years of practice. But I was expecting a lot of, because Obama was the, I was expecting a lot of bones through the nose. I was expecting just like the kind of stuff that you did end up seeing. But in my experience, it felt pretty cherry picked of people trying to find the most outrageous looking poster in a crowd of 150,000. Or whatever. Most of the people that I saw, there wasn't really almost anything about immigration. There was nothing about welfare. Everything that I had, we'd grown up with as like either code words or more just like policy stalking horses for perhaps other concerns was gone. There wasn't a word about affirmative action. There still isn't really. People don't talk about that anymore. So none of those things were was what was being talked about. What was being talked about was government spending too much. Obamacare is too big of a leap. And as you know from talking to these people, I had a whole lot of people who like, you know what? I feel bad that we're coming out in 2009. We should have been here in 2007. And so I think as part of that, we probably undersold or underappreciated the level of cultural grievance that would end up attaching to that. So the like Sarah Palin, who was a really interesting politician at the time that she was tabbed to be vice presidential pick for John McCain, governor of Alaska, she was an actual reformist. She would tackle Republicans who were corrupt and this kind of stuff. It was just an interesting character. I think she's a case of kind of audience capture where she saw that what got people excited and what led crowds to go nuts for her was her sort of being a lightning rod for an overall sense of cultural grievance that the elite institutions look down at us. And that sense, which we've covered and I've seen and witnessed, and it is expressed in anti-media sentiment, it's expressed in a lot of different ways, I think we, and I mean everybody, not just Reason, underestimated how much that was important both to the Republican Party, also to the Tea Party itself, and that sense, and a lot of other stuff can be smuggled underneath that sense of cultural grievance. Any issue that seems to be one in which the elites are on this side and the regular folk are on that side.
Well, it cuts both ways too, right? Because you're right, and you know, God, I feel like we're talking about 1808 or something rather than 2008. It all seems so very long ago, or 2012. But Palin was hated by elites of both the Republican Party and the certainly the Democratic Party and kind of liberal media. What was interesting is that she had an accent. It wasn't like a dumb hick Southern accent, but it was seen as a hick accent. She didn't help her case in a number of television appearances that went poorly. She really was kind of the first, I think, true bubbling up of a populism that would come to, fruition, if that's the right word for it, under Donald Trump. And of course, it's funny that Trump, as a billionaire who was born with a silver spoon in his mouth, is somehow, the spokesman for populism, whereas somebody who grew up in the middle of nowhere in Idaho and Alaska was the first kind of real emanation of that. But she's obviously nowhere at this point in terms of a political future.
And so this tumult, I feel like we, and now I mean not the whole universe, but more me and you, predicted a lot of the kind of mechanics of it. I think we rightly pointed out in first the essay that we wrote for the 40th anniversary issue in 2008, which, to be sure, that essay came out. This is one that said, hey, we're living in a libertarian moment. That essay came out right as the gong was hitting on the financial crisis. So right after Bush's speech. So right. People don't realize this. I mean, as they've been poo-pooing, like, hey, where's our libertarian moment? That thing was written as, in sense, a desperate cry for help, or at least a rallying cry for those of us who were staring bleakly into the darkness at that moment. And also to point out, and I think very rightly so, that libertarian stuff happens and gains and victories happen oftentimes, even most of the times, outside the realm of certainly national politics, right. and sometimes politics altogether.
Well, can we talk a little bit about that? Because it is, that is essential to the kind of conceptualization of the libertarian moment. And, for all of the guff that I think we've taken for, it's a real libertarian moment when Donald Trump starts, locking up children, in detention centers and things like that. But you're right. I mean, and I'm thinking of whole issues that you put together, special issues on things like criminal justice reform back in 2011, where, suddenly, we're talking about criminal justice reform, things like pot legalization, which is now almost, I hesitate to say it's a done deal, but it's, moving forward faster and faster. Can you talk a little bit about, are there places where libertarian sensibilities are actually carrying the day but are not being represented as such for whatever reason?
Yeah, I once gave a talk to a bunch of interns on Capitol Hill 2-3 years ago, I think, at the request of Rand Paul, who's nice enough to invite me to address them. And the topic was, okay, how do good libertarian things happen? And when you look at it, there is no one right true way. The Hayek was right about all that stuff. You can just look at tick them off. Even things that happened in the period of time between the financial crisis and the rise of Donald Trump. So, George Will told you and I that we're living in an authoritarian moment.
Right.
And I think he's got some reason to believe that. However, what have we seen since then? We've seen suddenly legal recreational marijuana in a quarter of the country. That was unthinkable. It was literally unthinkable. You had to be a crazy person to think that was possible. Even now, when we have a guy who's an unrepentant drug warrior as attorney general, even he can't roll it back to the dark old days of Obama's first term of crushing medical marijuana in California and things like that. It's amazing. That's one. Another one, gay marriage, right? Regardless of how it got there Supreme Court-wise, let's table that aside for a second and talk about it more in terms of societal acceptance of it. And was it just 2008 California had its proposition? Which one?
That sounds
eight,
about right. Yeah, it was Prop 8. Rhymes with
so
hate.
In California, blue California, liberal, enlightened California, they're like, no, screw this. We're not going to have gay marriage.
Yeah, we're not legalizing gay marriage. And which is, again, this is how, man, that is, I think Jesse Walker is the one who turned me on to the phrase that the past is another planet. And man, that's, that's 10 years ago.
But then ask yourself, what are the big drivers of gay marriage? And yes, it was eventually ratified at the Supreme Court level, but it was more about the societal, just complete overhaul of opinion on that. And I think you can argue that started in Hollywood. It started with Will and Grace. It started with Ellen DeGeneres. It started with, like, hey, look, we're going to come out. And
it started
gonna be okay.
With Bert and Ernie on Sesame Street. And Jack Klugman and Tony Randall in The Odd Couple. Come on, if we're going down that route, Uncle Charlie and Fred McMurray and My Three Sons. I mean, it's been with us forever.
Or what's his face in North by Northwest?
Martin Landau.
Martin Landau, exactly. Yes. But that's an amazing thing, and happens. That happened kind of culturally more than anything else. Look at the recognition of the Second Amendment as an individual right. That happened in 2008, right? 2010, 2008, around there. Maybe it's 2010, and then the incorporation was 2012. At any rate, that happened more or less, and Damon Root has written wonderfully about this, both in a cover story, which is one of our better ones in my era, Libertarians v. Conservatives, and also in his book, Overruled, which sprang from that. This is a victory for the long-term libertarian legal movement. These are theorists like Randy Barnett and others, Dave Koppel, who've been working on these issues, doing original research on these issues for 30 years, 35 years. Federalist society on some level, you know, which is at least half libertarian or libertarian friendly, there's a genuine split between more libertarian leading justices and kind of a theories behind that, and more conservative. The Robert Bork is the conservative, and they tend to defer to majorities. Mm-hmm. The libertarians tend to say, hey, look, no, we need to revive things like the 14th Amendment and to be more activist in protecting the Constitution. So it came from that. So that's a long-term project that can seem like it's in left field and you have no chance of winning 30 years ago, and then suddenly, bada-boom, 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 and now we're seeing people not just on the gun issue, but on a number of things like free speech at the Supreme Court level is really good these days. Neil Gorsuch is bringing a very interesting sense of, like, you know, the language of the law matters, and we should pay some fealty to that. So these victories happen in a lot of different ways. And you know, horse race national politics isn't usually the way. And so I think we got that stuff right. And I think also we recognized that there's a weakness to the two major parties. There's a fatigue associated with them, even as, because of structural reasons, they still live on in these sort of desiccated husks, but that made them vulnerable to takeover and to reshape in various images. And for a while, the Tea Party was reshaping the Republican Party in opposition to Obama in a much more robustly fiscally conservative, but also... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask, you know, I find this, I could build a whole theory out of it, Matt, and I think it would be largely accurate that, you know, what you're talking about here are ideas and issues, not personality. So it's not like, oh, you know, George Bush chewed with his mouth open and Barack Obama was imperious and fond of stupid linguistic or rhetorical conceits, like there are those who say, you know, what you're talking about are issues and whatnot. But somebody like, you know, Barack Obama was the president for basically the entirety of your term. Where does he fit into this context of, you know, and clearly Obamacare, both, you know, and I believe it was William Galston, a professor of public policy, a longtime Democratic consultant to presidents and whatnot. He wrote a piece not too long ago before Obama left office saying, you know, Obama blew his opportunity to really help the economy and to fix kind of government finance because he went with Obamacare rather than some, you know, rather than an actual economic plan that made sense. In a lot of ways, I think you could probably argue that, you know, Obama did something that nobody had been able to do before, which was to get a kind of nationalized healthcare system through. You know, this had been everybody's dream since at least Harry Truman on the progressive side. Obama made it happen with the thinnest of margins possible. But he also dragged the Republican Party into this weird kind of place where they were pretending for 8 years that they were going to repeal, replace, and, you know, whatever, repeat Obamacare. You know, where does Obama fit into this as a change agent or a change reagent? Does he matter in your kind of looking back at that period, 2008, 2016?
I wrote a piece that surprisingly doesn't give me as much guff as others have done, but saying that it's very possible, this is maybe in 2014, 15, it's very possible that we will look back 20 years from now, 30 years from now, and say Barack Obama had the most libertarian presidency of any recent president. Now, you could hear a lot of qualifiers in there.
Okay.
I mean, it's a tallest dwarf situation by
right.
a lot.
Yes.
But with very rare exception, it's not due to any action that he took. Why people would think of that? Because it's those libertarian victories happened on his watch, right? He very tentatively started tiptoeing late in his presidency towards the direction of a criminal justice reform that will play out and that will take place and be ratified maybe by this president, more likely by the next president. But he started us down that direction. He started us down the direction of the federal government no longer, even though it had in his first term, but no longer using the whip hand to kind of toe into line all of the states that want to do marijuana legalization and reforms, right? He enforced that heavily, but then he stopped. So that kind of happened on his watch. Gay marriage, the Joe Biden trial balloon. Democrats would be convicted of, like, hate speech, according to 2018 rules, if you just cut and pasted what they were saying about all this stuff in 2008. Yet it happened on his watch, even though he wasn't brave about it. And because of that, he will kind of be given credit for it. I think that the ways in which history will not judge him kindly, and I certainly do not judge him kindly, is that the method by which he got through Obamacare was brutal. He just lied his face off constantly about this stuff, both on terms of
and he had to. Policy. Yeah, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yes, he. So you can keep your doctor, but you'll die. Something like that, yeah. Right?
Yeah, and that, you know, this is a victory against all the special interests that were against us. It's like, no, this was written by special interests. You put them all in the room and gave them a pen.
Well, and can I ask, in good faith, one of the things that was awful, and I know that you covered this and Reason did, but, you know, this was probably the first time since the Civil War that legislation was passed by one party. Transformative legislation, to use a formulation that I think Charles Rangel, as well as Obama and other people, used to describe Obamacare. It was all Democratic votes, not all of the Democrats, but it was all Democratic votes. And going down to, I think it was Ben Nelson of Nebraska was the last guy, you know, who ended up getting all the diabetic coma inducing sweeteners at the very end. And then, you know, he was out of the Senate by the end of that term of his. But was that, is that a kind of signature move of Obama because he had to? Like, there was the Republicans famously were going to make him a one-term president. That was their only, you know, legislative priority. Or was it because Obama refused to compromise or wouldn't work to build a consensus? Do you think that matters? Yeah,
I do. I do. This is what I think separates me from a lot of people who of libertarian bent who are more of the let it all burn kind of thing. I think these kind of democratic small d norms, to use a terrible word, matter somewhat. I think smash mouth victories on major stuff is a bad way to go. I think the way that Mitch McConnell blocked consideration of Merrick Garland, I think Neil Gorsuch is obviously so much better jurist than Merrick Garland. Not even close. I'm really happy that he's that guy. I like the results. But the process of saying, no, we're just not going to even go through with a vote here for a year just because it's going to lead to the better outcome, I think all of that is bad. It's debasing the political culture, and I think it's going to it is already leading to some bad pathologies going forward, where everything is just sort of winner takes all. Whoever gets the presidency and a majority can inflict punishment, active punishment, on the other side, and it's going to be tit for tat until something blows up on that. And I think we can pin some of that on Obama. Another thing I'd like to pin on Obama, it's a great failure. He had some libertarians, civil libertarians in particular, excited in 2008 in 2007 because he campaigned against the war. He was the anti-war candidate. Now, we were smart enough to actually cover all this in real time and say, no, he's not anti-war. He's anti-dumb war, and he's got his own dumb ideas about what's a smart war, which we saw certainly play out in Libya and also in the surge, I believe, in Afghanistan.
Absolutely. No, that surge, that's why we won Afghanistan and we're no longer there, Matt, right? You know, and the Buddhas, those Buddhas are looking shinier and newer than ever. It's like it's all good in Afghanistan.
There was a moment early in his presidency that we paid attention to, Glenn Greenwald paid attention to, and no one else for the most part, which is he had campaigned on, we're going to get all them Abu Ghraib photos out. We got to get this stuff. We have to process it. We have to be open with it. And to his credit, he did end our torture program officially, although some black sites were still used, and certainly he was droning people to death at record rates. But as soon as this happens all the time, like once you have the awful, awful responsibility of power, it's like, oh, you know, it would be kind of a pain in the ass if half the Muslim world was rioting. Should we release these things? So, no, we're actually going to keep suppressing them. That was a blown opportunity. And generally speaking, you know, he was a guy who was showered with transparency awards in this first like week and a half as president because he'd made some vows that he was going to be the most transparent administration.
Well, and then he
was awful. He was awful on
that
issue.
You, I remember taking, you know, really kind of digging the knife in rightly when Edward Snowden broke and Obama was, you know, saying things along the lines of like, well, you know, now that I think of it, and now that like all of my secrets are out, I do really welcome, you know, the conversation about state surveillance. And it was like, thanks, pal. That's, you know, that's you really got out in front of that one.
Yeah, he did a similar thing in September, October of 2012. There's a micro moment, I think, after one of the debates where Mitt Romney came out and gutted him pretty good, which is fascinating, actually, a micro moment, because what he did is use Obama's exact same words in the 2008 debate against him, without mentioning that, but Obama knew it, and you could see it on his face, and you're like, oh, it was great. Anyways, there was a moment when it seemed like Romney had a somewhat of a chance, and in that moment, Obama's like, oh shit, we need to look at the rules that we have for like assassinating people and droning people and doing all the secret war stuff, like, because, you know, we might have a bad president next time. That is in a nutshell so much of what is wrong with you know, modern democratic discourse when it comes to war making and a whole bunch besides. It like government power only is a problem when Republicans wield it, and a lot of Republicans do similar things on the other end.
Sure.
And it's our lonely and fun job at Reason to constantly point this out without dying in a sea of whataboutism, but just to keep the eyes affixed on power, which is something that we did. You mentioned criminal justice before, and I mean, this happened later in my tenure, but the whole kind of, you know, Snowden and all that happened in 2013. And then in 2014, it was Ferguson and a lot of kind of a nationalization of a lot of the criminal justice things that we've been writing about for a really long time. And for a while there, at least in those original weeks of Ferguson, we started seeing the country use terms and look at issues that we've been using and looking at for years. So things like the militarization of police, a great Radley Balco phrase, suddenly was on the tips of everyone's tongue. Right now we're seeing this with, and we've seen it the last couple of years, civil asset forfeiture, just what an awful thing that is, or the way local cities just shake down their poorest residents in the criminal justice system as a way to fund their operations. These are things that we've been writing about for a long time, and unfortunately, I think too much of the discussion gets routed into just a pure kind of sorting of people into the categories. Are you racist or are you not racist? While I think those are discussions that are worth having and exploring, we've been trying to keep people's eyes on the prize of power. Okay, let's imagine that everything is as racist as you say it is. Then you really need to go after the power of police unions or of prosecutors who have immunity from bad actions and all these kinds of things. And that's what we have to do constantly. And I think that we did so, at least on some occasions, with criminal justice and a few other things, also on campus rape thing with Kathy Young, cover story that we did.
Yeah, I wanted to bring that up. Yeah, this was the January 2014 cover story of Reason Magazine, and it was certainly for me, you know, it was the first notice paid to an Obama-era change in the way that universities were told if they wanted to continue getting federal funding to comply with sexual harassment or sexual assault charges on campuses. Talk a little bit about Kathy Young's guilty until proven innocent story. And then, you know, where do you see the movement for free speech and kind of transparency and due process on college campuses, both on college campuses, but in the larger culture?
There's a couple of moments. That was one of them. There was one that preceded that, a Greg Lukianoff piece. And these are related. He's the president of the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, FIRE. And the Luciana piece, which I believe was in 2009, sprung out of a conversation he and I had. And yeah, I'm dumb. We're all dumb. We don't know what's going on in the world. And I said to him back then, and this seems quaint, the past is another planet, et cetera, like, hey, you know, I remember all those PC controversies from the 90s. They kind of went away, didn't they? And he's like, my God, no. What's wrong with you? They've been around. They're just not getting attention. So he wrote a piece on my request because I found that to be eye-opening called PC Never Died. And I think that that's eventually made its way into a sort of a thesis for his next book that came out of that. But it sort of talked about the way that a lot of this stuff had become institutionalized, that the anti-free speech action by a lot of kind of committees and boards and in academia was more widespread than ever, but it was no longer getting attention. Well, of course, now it is getting attention. And one way that it kind of got a lot of attention was the change in the Obama administration's interpretations of Title IX to kind of pressure universities to adjudicate sexual assault disputes in ways where it was more about the preponderance of the evidence rather than kind of beyond a reasonable doubt type of way. And so campuses responded by basically installing kangaroo courts for people where you couldn't really even cross-examine witnesses. You couldn't do anything. And people in some cases, and Robbie Suave has made a living mm-hmm. out of writing about a lot of these cases where the alleged perpetrator is cleared of all possible wrongdoing by the local cops, who might say, oh yeah, the accusation is wrong. Or sometimes in this case, the accusation was withdrawn by the original accuser, and it doesn't matter. They're kicked out of the university and all this. I didn't really realize this was going on until Kathy Young's piece. Since then, we've seen just a number of these discussions, and The Atlantic has done a series of pieces. And Betsy DeVos, to her credit, and the Trump administration to theirs, withdrew that Title IX guidance. I think the guidance itself was applied maybe 2011, 2012, sometime mm-hmm. around there. And now, since it's been withdrawn, which is great for beginning to sort of peel back the injustices, although they are in many senses ongoing on a more localized level. But this always gets people's attention. The line was guilty until proven innocent. This is also true of the aforementioned civil asset forfeiture, where your stuff is declared guilty even if you're not charged with a crime. People have a basic sense that that's wrong in America, and it's just a matter of letting people know about it. It's any magazine editor's desire to have cover stories change the way that you think about something, or to like just punch you in the jaw and say, oh my God, really? That's going on? So that story was very much a part of that. And hopefully it influenced. I mean, when Betsy DeVos came out with her revised guidelines for Title IX, she mentioned, you know, a dozen scare stories. We'd covered all of them.
Yeah.
We literally had covered all. She was referring constantly to Robbie Suave work as she was talking about rolling back the thing that helped create these senses of injustices. So it's gratifying to see when our work leads to very individualized cases of injustice being undone, or in policy shifts that will prevent further injustices from happening.
Can you, as we enter kind of the last section of this podcast, could you talk a little bit about how you discovered Reason? I mean, you were born in 1968, the year that Reason was founded. Well, you know, what's your kind of personal journey along the line of Reason, libertarianism, a movement, a kind of pro-freedom movement? And, you know, how have you changed over, you know, I think you first got involved working at Reason and writing for Reason in the very early 2000s. You know, how has that changed your thinking? And, you know, where do you see the future of kind of libertarian thought or sensibilities?
I first got introduced to Reason and libertarianism more, I would say, by my stepdad, Mike Townsend, great guy, married my mom when I was around 12. And he started, he wanted me to read Ayn Rand, and I tried. It didn't work. But I got into the Robert Heinlein stuff because, killing and sex, that sounded good to me.
Yeah.
So Reason was around there. At that point, for me, it was kind of indistinguishable from Omni magazine, both typographically,
right,
and kind of content-wise.
And Omni was the Bob Guccione Science Futurist magazine, right? The publisher of Penthouse had Omni.
Super glossy.
Heavy. I mean, it's. I remember it as being like the thickness of a phone book or something, but super sleek and filled with shiny, kind of metallic people doing shiny metallic things in zero gravity.
So I wasn't like going deep on Jack Wheeler's Contra coverage and stuff or anything like that. But I was aware that it existed, and I was aware here that there was this sort of a category that we might call libertarian. I didn't associate myself with one, but I'd always been attracted to the civil libertarianism of a new left generation of writers and thinkers. I was a big fan of Hunter Thompson back in the day, Tom Wolfe stuff.
You talk about the tradition, which is mostly dead, of the anti-authoritarian left, right? Of the anti-authority left.
Like my old pal Bob Scheer, Rubber Scheer, who was an old Ramparts hand. I went to a college with his son and started a paper with him in Eastern Europe. But Bob, I'd known his career before I met his son. And what I appreciated about him is he wrote for Playboy, wrote for the LA Times. But he always had this sense of, I have a journalistic responsibility to go after my own team. And even if I disagree with Bob, which is every day that I take a breath in the air, his sense of journalistic responsibility and patriotic responsibility is one that I've always found very, very attractive. And it is, sadly, I think, rare here. To bracket all of this stuff, this maybe explains my future self more than I knew at the time. But in high school, my thesis English paper, big paper at the end of the year in English class, which my teacher tried to talk me out of so much because we had to like grapple with a classic bit of literature. So I chose Stranger in a Strange Land. And my thesis about it was that it predicted and sometimes provided a blueprint for Haight-Ashbury communes in 1967. It was called The Martian and the Hippies, was my thesis.
All right.
I think
you know what? I want to tell you right now that I'm grokking that, Matt. I'm grokking that paper.
You're a grokking man. Yeah. this is kind of where I came from. I then re-encountered reason after I came back to America in 1998, and it just lived online. It was kind of libertarians punched above their weight, I think, in the early internet, and they kind of still do.
Although I will speak only for myself that I think my weight has finally caught up to my punching power, or maybe my punching power has decreased.
But I started catching it more heavily in 99 and 2000, I was just very attracted to the, frankly, kind of Gillespian approach, the sort of a gleeful anti-politics to its political coverage, writing and talking about politics in a way that is more like how people do it when they're drinking a Pacifico in their backyard and just talking smack about the local or national polls and poking a finger into the ribs of the self-seriousness of it all. That was very attractive to me to it. My first piece, I think I pitched you like as they're still pulling bodies out of the Twin Towers there, because the places that I had been writing for then suddenly kind of locked up on me, and I began looking for new markets, and I was also sort of exploring new things. I started writing a bit for you back then. The biggest change in me, besides just prolonged exposure to libertarianism, always makes your face turn blue from the colloidal silver and all that, is that, I didn't self-describe as a libertarian necessarily. I ended up doing but was on campaign finance reform. And that's kind of a big, deal. I was on the other side of that issue. Before, I was very attracted to the candidacies of Jerry Brown in '92, Ralph Nader in 2000, which I covered, and I voted for him despite all the things that I learned while covering him. But I believed, I shared their belief that, and John McCain's belief that money was uniquely corrupting the system, making people change their behavior, and that was the reason why whatever kind of glorious fill in the blank wasn't happening on the issues that I cared about, which were many, you know, civil libertarian issues and drug war and things like that. I presume that it was a question of campaign finance. I was wrong about that, which I learned through prolonged exposure, but also teasing, you know, probing the ideas of people like former Federal Elections Commission Chair Brad Smith, who was influential on that. But also, I had to recognize in myself that I was poo-pooing a free speech objection. And as someone who had always considered myself a free speech absolutist or near absolutist, because I still haven't watched The Human Centipede, you know, that... just I've lived it. That's different.
Yeah.
But that, you know, Mitch McConnell was bringing up a free speech objection, and instead of poo-pooing it, let's investigate it. Let's give it the benefit of the doubt and see where that goes. And then you realize, oh my God, I've been pro-censorship. This is and pro-censorship of political ideas and communications. That's terrible. So that was the biggest shift. And reason is very much part of that. And ultimately, I mean, that probably propelled some of my interest and critique of John McCain, which came later, and this type of stuff. So that has changed me. I will say that the thing that will make you more libertarian than anything else is not necessarily even working for Reason and hanging out with freaker libertarians and wonderful, you know, subscribers from the early days. We get to meet when we go out in the world, and that's always just a tremendous. But it's from working at the LA Times for 2 years, especially in the editorial board, because you have all the political grandees come through. You know, here's Schwarzenegger, here's Antonio Villaraigosa, here's Gavin Newsom. They come through and they speak, and everybody around the table speaks, no matter who's coming through, it's activists, politicians, whoever. It's this language. It's like, we're just going to get a tri-directional win with all the stakeholders. Hmm. And you see how this stuff gets done. I mean, I was there right after the Kelo decision came down, and I watched the then city councilman later to become mayor, his current mayor, and thinks that he's a presidential aspirant, Eric Garcetti, fight against me in particular on using eminent domain to turf out some businesses in order to get the city to build a 5-star hotel at Hollywood and Vine, and just to see how people justify this. You say, Matt, it's like the ring of power. You really don't want to use it because it can become corrupting, but sometimes you just have to have that fight in front of you.
Wow.
And this is the default of how stuff gets done. They're the worst, most anti-libertarian policies do not happen on the federal level, with the notable exceptions of war making and some other stuff. But like the workaday anti-libertarian crap is just baked into so many big cities, including the one that I live in now in New York, that it drives you nuts. So that's what turns you into a libertarian more even than prolonged exposure to Reason Magazine, although that does help too.
A final question. We've been talking kind of about the first 50 years of Reason and libertarian thought, libertarian ideas, libertarian culture, politics. Do you feel libertarianism is vibrant right now, or what do you see as kind of the next battlegrounds for libertarian ideas?
I think the culture of it is vibrant, and it's also contested and so sort of tumultuous in an interesting way. You see this almost as a stalking horse in the world of politics with a Libertarian Party, which is, you know, undergoing all this kind of self-examination and tussles and fights after having done 3 times better than they've ever done before and really firmly establishing itself as the third party in this country at a time when the two major parties are undergoing like just kind of radical shakeups. So it is possible that we're going through just on the politics level, national politics level, a shakeup, a reformation, the likes of which we really haven't seen in 100 years since I think the rise of the progressive movement in the 1912 election, which George Will has written about recently to great effect. The libertarian tendency could come out of that being much more potent, organized, and formalized. I wouldn't bet on it.
Right.
Certainly wouldn't bet on it at all. But like, we don't know what's going to happen, and we do know that people who are sort of openly out and proud libertarians are going to be near that action. And so it's going to be really interesting to see what happens just there in that political realm. And in the broader conversations, it's been fascinating to see rise of entire subcultures of libertarians that didn't exist or just weren't activated on this stuff. Right now, it's all about cryptocurrency and blockchain stuff. Though that group of libertarians is just huge. It has a ton of juice. It's interesting. There's always been a tech libertarian kind of fusion out there since the very first days of all of it. But these things just kind of rise up. I'm very gratified that the kind of the Radley Balco libertarian group, I was worried. I mean, the criminal justice issue that I did came out in 2011. It was right when Radley was leaving, going to Huffington Post. I had been worried at that moment, like, you know, does that line of coverage fizzle out when its most sort of well-known practitioner exits the building, even though Jacob Sullivan and other people do write about that. And my God, no, this is just, that's a permanent feature of both libertarianism and libertarian journalism going forward. So that's just like a new path, and it's there, it's with us. So there's going to be new paths that we currently can't wrap our brains around. I am more than confident. And I think that's very interesting. And I think there's going to be kind of a wave back. We might get reinvigorated, you know, broadly as a country, and then also narrowly kind of as a libertarian thing by the amount of freedom that has sloshed out in the world over the last 25 years, which is like the greatest underappreciated story in humanity. Last 30 years at this point, because in the Cold War is 89 now. But like when you pull that many people, a billion people out of poverty, when suddenly people can travel in ways that were unimaginable here, the true believers of the stuff the reason's been fighting all these years, in many senses, come from outside this country. And we need that reinvigoration. So I think they're going to bring stuff to us that we haven't even fathomed before, and ways of networking with one another, and just kind of new tributaries and streams of this stuff. And I'm completely jazzed to imagine what that might look like and what kind of experiments in living we might see from that. And I think it's really hard for the individualization of our lives to be rolled back, despite the atavistic fever dreams of both Donald Trump-flavored populism and Bernie Sanders-flavored populism.
All right. Well, we will leave it there. Thank you so much, Matt. That was a wonderful, invigorating note to end on. We've been talking with Matt Welch. Matt, of course, was editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine from 2008 through spring of 2016. We're celebrating Reason's 50th birthday, 50th anniversary. We were founded as a magazine in 1968. We are now a full-fledged media outfit. Matt, thanks so much for talking.
Thank you, Nick. Good fun.
This has been the Reason Podcast, and I've been your host, Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to us at iTunes and rate and review us while you're there. Thanks for listening.